Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. This week on Culturetopia, country crossover star Shania Twain talks about the uncommonly hard personal travails she's faced as part of a new memoir. In Libya, a home for artists producing anti-government posters, musicians rehearsing, and no longer silenced under Gaddafi's regime. And a look at the publishing industry's rush to get books about Osama bin Laden's death to readers. But first,
Los Angeles has a Mexican-American mayor and the largest Latino population in the country. Now it has a new museum and cultural center celebrating the city's Mexican roots. Today on Cinco de Mayo, NPR's Mandalí del Barco reports on how La Plaza highlights the city's complex history.
Let me tell you a little something about L.A.
I love it!
La Plaza pays tribute to the histories and identities of L.A.'s Mexicanos, Californios, Mexican-Americans, and Chicanos, everyone from musicians in the group Ozo Motley to the 44 settlers who arrived from Mexico in 1781 to establish the city of Los Angeles.
Los Ángeles de Nuestra Señora la Reina de Porciúncula.
La Plaza president and CEO Miguel Ángel Corzo says the original pobladores colonized the region for Spain. Now his center's mission is to collect and preserve the folklore of those who followed.
There is a tremendous tradition in our culture of storytelling. We've all sat and listened to our grandfather and our grandmother tell stories. The stories are mesmerizing.
Stories like the forced deportations to Mexico during the Great Depression. Government agents drove out 1 million people, many of them American citizens. In one video shown at La Plaza, Emilia Castañeda tells what it was like to be rounded up and packed into railroad boxcars in 1935.
We had to be there early to board a train, and it was very crowded. We were crying. Who wouldn't be crying? We're going to an unknown place. What do I know about Mexico?
Another display features the sharp coats and hats worn by young pachucos in the L.A. barrios during World War II.
It was a secret fantasy of every vato, living in or out of the pachucada, to put on the zoot suit.
Riots between zoot suiters and white sailors led to a famous murder, a trial, and eventually a hit Broadway musical and film. La Plaza also features the story of the late L.A. Times journalist Ruben Salazar, whose anti-war writings inspired Chicanos in East L.A.
We seem to lose more of our people in Vietnam in proportion to the rest of the population.
L.A. sheriff's deputies shot and killed Salazar during an infamous protest. La Plaza spotlights other movements by farm workers, Chicano youth, and undocumented immigrants. Here's labor organizer Dolores Huerta.
Our struggle is not over, right?
The heart of La Plaza is in the oral histories of Latinos. Visitors can contribute their own tales in a recording booth with less than perfect audio.
Our grandpa's dad fought in the Mexican Revolution.
This young visitor tells how his great-grandfather fought with Pancho Villa in the Mexican Revolution. La Plaza's own story is controversial, and it's offended an even earlier culture here. It's located downtown next to an old Native American burial ground, and during construction,
they were taking bones out with buckets and bags.
Bernie Acuña is chairman of the Tongva tribe that's lived in the area for centuries. He says construction crews dug up the remains of more than 100 people.
And I think it's very disrespectful and a desecration of our ancestors. We were the original Los Angelinos. We were here before anybody was. We were the original people here.
The old burial ground remains fenced off, and the center's current exhibition does mention the Tongva Indians. The county supervisor who helped create La Plaza has repeatedly apologized to Native American descendants. The tension speaks to the ongoing story of multicultural Los Angeles. Mandalí del Barco, NPR News.
There are a lot of young people involved in Libya's rebellion. They're members of the rebel military. They're working to help form a new government. And they're producing revolutionary artwork, publications, and music. Our own Peter Breslow has this look at a place in eastern Libya where a rising generation of creative activists gather for the sake of revolution.
On any given day, you can find at least a few of Benghazi's young and restless in a large, empty cement lot off one of the city's main thoroughfares. In the late afternoon, young men gather to see just how much tire rubber they can burn. Fishtailing Toyotas leave a smear of swirling and smoking sticky blackness on the pavement. From a hotel room high above, the streaks appear like some kind of very postmodern design. About a mile away, just off Revolution Square, more substantive creations are taking shape. This is the media center for the 17th of February Revolution, a dingy, dog-eared building, bustling day and night with frenetic 20 and 30-somethings trying to process what's going on here in Libya. On the second floor, a cottage industry of sorts has developed producing anti-Gaddafi posters. The walls are plastered with mainly black and white cartoons of the leader. In one, he's a fanged vampire with bombs and machine guns popping out the top of his head. In another, the colonel is depicted as a monkey picking lice off a crony. They all ooze vitriol. 32-year-old Akram Mohammed El-Biriki, one of a cadre of cartoonists working at the center, says he cranks out 4 to 5 drawings a day. This afternoon, the caricature he's working on presents the dictator in oversized sunglasses, dripping blood from the lower half of his body. The artist, sporting a goatee and jean jacket, says he used to draw his sketches at home in secret and then tear them up for fear of being discovered and imprisoned. When things quiet down, Biriki hopes for a career in fashion or interior design, occupations, he says, that were stifled under the old regime. Overseeing things at the center and making sure the cartoonists stay on message is Suzanne Hemi, who helped found the place. Hovering about in a dark headscarf, Hemi says she tries to make sure that as the artists lampoon Gaddafi, they don't offend any of Libya's tribes. Hemi studied law, but says she found her true calling in the uprising that began in February, demonstrating against the regime and admonishing the men to join her. She urged her husband and 17-year-old son to take up arms, telling them that if they die as martyrs, and if they live as revolutionaries. Up one more flight of stairs at the media center is the rehearsal space for Guys Underground. In a cramped room packed with a drum kit and guitars, the band is polishing its latest download, Revolution.
You know, it's like illegal to perform a rock concert here in Libya. You have to get invaded, you have to get a pass, you have to call somebody, and somebody calls somebody. And it was the somebody system, you know. Before the revolution, you have to think like 100 times before you do anything.
Medical student Marwan Fatala Gargoum is Guys Underground's bass player and songwriter. He says the group, which has been around since 2007, is finally able to express itself the way it wants. But with family living in dangerous places like Misrata, Zawiya, and Tripoli, sometimes he hesitates.
I'm very happy. I had a feeling, amazing feeling. I swear I never had in my life. Also, there's things that sometimes when I'm talking, I feel afraid about the people. I know there's my Muslim family in Misrata, and I had Muslim of them in Zawiya or in Tripoli, so I feel afraid about them because they might like kidnap my brother or do bad things for him.
Despite the worries, Gargoum says he and his friends become energized once they set foot in the media center.
I finish my work, I start in the morning, I come here. You're not feeling tired to rehearse or do any songs. Like before we said, I'm tired, I have to go home. But now you're going here, you find the painting, the drawing, you find studios, you find the newspaper, and all of them like enjoying doing their work. You know, even like we stay here till 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. and it's okay, like, because we love what we're doing here.
Lately, the band has been collaborating with local rap singers, but sometimes they go traditional, bringing in an oud player. Gargoum says Guys Underground songs aren't explicitly anti-Gaddafi. Rather, he wants his music, like the upcoming release Revolution, to honor people who have died in the uprising and to lift the spirits of those still fighting.
People die in whole streets. Blood and tears on the feet.
Guys Underground have plans for a big concert, they say, right after Muammar Gaddafi is gone from the scene. Peter Breslow, NPR News.
And you can see some of the cartoons of Muammar Gaddafi that are popping up around Benghazi at npr.org.
Oh, we are saved. Artist Glenn Ligon is African-American, gay, and grew up working class in the Bronx. While his own life could provide plenty of inspiration for his work, he tends to look outside of himself for source materials. Ligon enlarges pre-existing images to gargantuan scale. He lifts words and phrases from comedy routines, books, poems, even erotic literature, and uses them to create unique visual pieces. One is now hanging in the White House. More than 100 of Ligon's works are on display now in New York, part of a mid-career retrospective called Glenn Ligon America. Glenn Ligon was my personal tour guide of his exhibition at the Whitney Museum of American Art. As we open and come out of the elevator to the gallery space, we are immediately confronted with a large, what looks like photograph, palms in the air. And reading the catalog, I read that this is a representation of the Million Man March. Tell us what it is you were capturing there.
It's actually a silkscreen. So it was derived from a newspaper photograph of the Million Man March, which was a march organized by Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam, in the mid-90s. And I took a very small image and blew it up to enormous scale. And so what happens when you do that is that the information in the image starts to become indistinct. The image darkens. So the sea of hands that you see in the image, which is a moment in the march where there was a pledge of the black men who had gathered there to the black family and to responsibility, becomes much more ambiguous. There's the context of the image becomes less clear. And by working with the image that way, I tried to think about that march or more broadly about history, how moments in history seem distinct at the moment that they're happening, but over time become indistinct, become more ambiguous.
Now, here we have a room full of packing boxes, and I do believe Billie Holiday is singing in one of them. This one here. What is the meaning of the packing boxes?
A lot of the work that I've done is based on reading a text and being struck by it. In this case, it was based on seeing an image and being struck by it. And the image was a lithograph from the 1840s of a slave named Henry Box Brown, who was a slave in a tobacco factory in Richmond, Virginia, and got the ingenious idea of getting a local white carpenter who was sympathetic to anti-slavery causes to make a crate for him, nail him inside of that crate, and mail the crate to an anti-slavery society in Philadelphia. And I became fascinated with the idea of this box as the container for the body, but also the idea that if he had spoken, it would have been the thing that would have given him away. And so the installation that I've done with these various packing crates in the dimensions of the box he was liberated from, I use those boxes filled with voices, because one thing that Henry Box Brown did when he was liberated from the crate was to sing. That was his first impulse. And I was thinking about how profound that is, not to speak, but to sing.
And of course you have Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit.
Right, exactly, an anti-lynching song. One of the things I was thinking about is we always talk about slavery as an event in the past. And I wanted to contemporize it in some way, to bring it forward. And so there's Billie Holiday singing, but then there's KRS-One, a rapper, singing Sound of the Police, you know, who makes this connection between police control and overseers. Mm-hmm. So as a way to sort of bring the notion of slavery into the present.
This strikes me as the kind of exhibition. It is attracting school kids, but, you know, I'm seeing, you know, the young black faces coming up from the schools and, you know, looking at a successful black artist who's been trained in fine art and yet is using, you know, some of those raw materials. I mean, do you see yourself as a role model in some way
I don't see myself as a role model, but I do think that my mother used to say that when I told her I wanted to be an artist, her famous line was, "The only artists I've ever heard of are dead." And what she meant was she'd heard of Picasso, but Picasso's dead. So it just wasn't in her experience. Though she was happy to send me to classes after school at the Metropolitan Museum and pottery classes, but I don't think she had a sense that one could be an artist because there wasn't anyone in my family who had done that. And so I think I'm not a role model, but I guess just by example, it would be harder for some parent to say, "You can't be an artist," because here I am.
And in the last room, you're working with neon. And we have three signs. Each one is America. There seems to be an America unplugged on one wall, a flashing America, and an America in neon, but with some of the letters transposed.
This whole body of work came out of thinking about Dickens.
Dickens?
Tale of Two Cities.
Uh-huh.
The very famous opening chapter of that, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And the first neon I made was in 2006, using the word America. And I used the word America because I realized after trying to think of a piece using the Dickens text, I realized actually Dickens is talking about a moment that a society is in where everything is happening and nothing is happening. Everything is booming and everyone is poor, you know, and sort of the dichotomies between rich and poor, progress and going backwards, seem to be where we were at in America. Those things going on at the same time seem to be embodied in the word America. So that's why it's blinking erratically, like it's shorted out.
And the one to the left of it with some of the letters turned around, as if we're looking at it like it's a neon sign in a window and we're looking through the window.
Right. It's actually the word America, but I realized that if you turn the letters around, it makes a very strange word. It's still the word America, but I literally turned each letter around. But because the A and the M and the I in the word America are symmetrical letters, when you turn them around, they seem to be facing you the right way, even though the other letters, the E, the R, and the C, are backwards. And so the sense that the word faces you and turns away from you at the same time is what I was interested in.
All right. Glenn Ligon, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was fun.
Glenn Ligon, America, will be at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York until June 5th. Go to our website, npr.org, to see images of Glenn Ligon's art, and you can hear him talk about some of the other works featured in the exhibition.
Rushing books to press is a common practice after big news events, and the publishing industry is wasting no time in getting out books about Osama bin Laden and the operation that led to his death. Contracts are being signed, deadlines are being pushed up, and a brand new e-book on the subject will be available to the public by Monday. NPR's Lynn Neary reports on the publishing world's quick strike operations.
When Mark Resnick learned about the death of Osama bin Laden, he knew the world had changed. He also knew he very likely had a bestseller on his hands. That's because Resnick is the editor of SEAL Team 6, a book about the inner workings of an elite unit of the Navy SEALs.
There were two levels to this. The first was when I woke up Monday morning and grabbed the newspaper off my driveway and saw he'd been killed and read that it was most likely SEALs. But it was not until an hour or two later when we started seeing that it was, in fact, SEAL Team 6 specifically that I realized that we had actually a very big opportunity.
Though obviously written before this week's events, Resnick says the book may give readers a better understanding of the role SEAL Team 6 played in the attack on bin Laden's compound.
They'll understand what it means to be a member of SEAL Team 6, what these men are, what makes a Navy SEAL, what goes into becoming a Navy SEAL, and I think through that they'll understand exactly who these men are, or at least close as they can to who the men are that could pull off such an incredible mission such as this.
The book was scheduled for release on May 24th, but the publisher moved it up to next Tuesday. That's the day after Random House releases its first instant ebook, an essay collection called Beyond Bin Laden. The editor, John Meacham, says the president was still speaking about the attack when he set the book in motion.
This book was born around 11:30 p.m. Eastern Time Sunday night.
Meacham, a former editor of Newsweek, only recently left journalism for publishing, so it's not surprising that his instinct was to take advantage of the speed afforded by digital publishing. Within 36 hours, he had essays written by a prestigious group of contributors, including former Secretary of State James Baker.
The people we have are all passionately engaged in the story and have been for more than a decade, whether it's obviously Secretary Baker or Karen Hughes, who was there at the beginning, Richard Haass, who was in the government when the attacks happened and is now at the council. Everyone was poised and, I think, eager to weigh in because it's such an enormous event.
Meacham says the essays focus on the future, assessing the tactics, policy, and military options in Afghanistan and Pakistan now that bin Laden is dead.
The book tries to look beyond what everyone is doing right now, which is desperately trying to find out exactly what happened. A noble, important endeavor. I spent years doing it. But there's no way for book publishers to compete with daily and now hourly, minute-to-minute journalists. That would be a fool's errand.
A couple of well-known experts on bin Laden, Afghanistan, and the War on Terror also got contracts this week to write traditional books. Those will take a little longer to get to the public, and no doubt negotiations are already underway for more books on the subject. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
We already know a lot about Shania Twain. Her powerful voice, years of hit songs. Her 1997 album, Come On Over, is the best-selling country music album of all time. But in recent years, her name has been splashed across tabloid headlines that might come straight out of a country song. Her husband ran off with her best friend, and just a few years later, Shania Twain married the man who had been married to the woman who wronged her. Now Shania Twain is telling her whole life story. She's written a memoir, From This Moment On, which starts in her hometown, Timmins, Ontario, 500 miles north of Toronto, where she had a sad, poor, tough, even chilling childhood. We talked to her from New York this week, and she talked about one of the main meals she shared with her family, a concoction called goulash.
Goulash, yeah. Although I never disliked goulash.
We're not talking about the Hungarian meat dish, but something else, because your folks were poor.
Exactly. We were poor, so when, our version of, whatever was available in the cupboards, but often it was hopefully milk. If there was milk, then we would make goulash with brown sugar, boiled milk, and broken up stale bread. And you know what? It was good.
Yeah. wasn't dessert. That was dinner, right?
That was dinner. That was breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, it wasn't all the time. It's not like we ate like that for months and months, but we would go in and out of really dry periods financially, and this bread, milk, and sugar concoction was a staple.
And there was, to be blunt about it, a lot of misery going on in the house too, wasn't there?
There was. We had a very turbulent family life. There was a lot of violence due to the stress of not being able to pay bills, made for very insecure and unstable environment for a child, which is basically what my life was for my entire childhood.
But you were the singing girl, too, weren't you? The little singer.
I was the little singer. That is how my mother always, what everybody always called me growing up. I was the little singer, and there was a lot of music in the house. This was a real savior for me because it was a great escape.
11 years old, you were asked to sing on the Tommy Hunter Show on the CBC, big country music show, and that entailed taking a train from Timmins.
Yeah, a long train ride from Timmins.
Kind of an adventure ensued.
My parents had put me on the wrong train, And I was headed off to British Columbia. Now, that's, you know, a three-day train ride, which is completely off course to where I was going to Toronto. Toronto was just an overnight sort of ride. It would have probably taken, you know, 15 hours or something like that.
And this is the days before cell phones and that sort of thing.
Yeah, no cell phones, nothing like that, no way to communicate with my parents. And so the conductor was able to stop that train in the middle of the northern bush, let me off on the side of the tracks with my guitar, and just said, wait here, and the next train that comes by is going to pick you up and take you to Toronto. And here I was in the middle of the bush, waiting for the next train, really wondering if it was going to come or not.
Yeah, well, it came and you got to Toronto, right?
It actually stopped.
Please tell me about the day when you were 13 years old, got up and decided, enough of this.
Yeah, you know, 13, I declared that year the worst year of my life. I was just really tired of never knowing what tomorrow was going to bring, if my parents would kill each other, as they'd almost done many times throughout our childhood. And living with that insecurity every day just started to get to me as an adolescent more than it had when I was a child. Or I wouldn't say more, I would say in a different way. I decided for myself that I was going to make my mother get in the car, take us away, and leave the whole thing behind. So I did exactly that. I got her up the following morning. You know, she was in a fog, in a pretty typical state of depression, made her coffee, lit her cigarette, and I just said, let's go. Drive. And that's what we did, and we drove to a battered woman's shelter.
We're speaking with Shania Twain, her new book, her memoir, From This Moment On. We'll note at some point your mother went back to your father. You were in Toronto, 22 years old, beginning a singing career, and got a phone call telling you your parents had died in a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
Changed your life.
It certainly did. I really felt completely alone. Of course, went through the shock and the grief of losing my parents, and also thought maybe I should just quit music too, because that was my mother's passion, my music career. So with her gone, it almost seemed as though there was no purpose to carry on, no reason to carry on, and now it's time to just get a real job and go back to school and become a whatever it is I want to do, you know, become a veterinarian or an architect, which were things I always had dreamt of doing. So it was a real turning point for me in big decision-making. But what ended up happening was, because we had still younger siblings at home, I ended up going back home and taking care of them and taking care of my parents' affairs. But thankfully, a friend of mine who had followed me along through my childhood career, who was also an artist, Mary Bailey, she really was the one who convinced me not to quit music altogether and maybe combine music and work to support my family. It paid, you know, the mortgage, it paid the heating and the electricity, it paid the food. You know, I did it out of necessity.
Yeah.
But it kept me in there. I'm wondering if it hadn't been for that, if I might have just decided after all to quit and just, you know, sing for myself in my bedroom for the rest of my life.
Do you know the hardest part of the book for me to read? And we're talking about a book where you detailed spousal abuse and misery and sadness and loss and death within the house. Reading about your father's abuse of you.
Right.
We're not talking about physical abuse, but something else.
The most disturbing part of my father's abuse towards me was the psychological abuse. I'm not surprised that he found that very disturbing, and it disturbs me still. But at the same time, what's harder for me is the confusion between how I knew him to be such a beautiful person, a very funny, happy-go-lucky guy. He went to great lengths to care for us the best that he could. He was kind. He was not judgmental. Yet, he had another side to him that seemed to be out of his control. And it was very scary and unpredictable. And then we'd never talk about it the next day as if it never happened. Just like any of the violent episodes in our household, we never talked about them the next day. It was just, All right, another day in the Twain household. We just carry on with life and buckle up and put on a smile and go skip off to school.
Shania, I almost hear a question from our listeners. How can you love a man like that?
You know, love is unconditional, family love. And that's why kids are so torn. And that's why a lot of abuse stays under the radar, because they don't want to report it. And I realize that as difficult as it is to talk about it, by talking about it and sharing it, I really believe a lot of people out there are going to feel less alone. And even if they feel they still need to stay under the radar for whatever reason, maybe they will feel that they aren't alone. People that read this book are going to say, whoa, I never would have suspected this from Shania. And maybe it will be liberating for them personally.
When you were a kid, singing was your refuge, your salvation. Now you're older, not a kid. How much can singing and music make up for the rough stuff that life has in store sometimes?
Music is a great natural high and a great natural escape. We need to be able to sing in the shower. We need to hear a song that breaks our heart. We need to hear a song that provokes our thinking and stirs our emotions. So I'm no different. I get a particular joy out of creating it, but I make it and I create it for the same reason others listen to it.
Shania Twain, her new book, a memoir, From This Moment On. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.